Hey, Feminist Frequency Radio listeners, this is Ebony, coming to you before the show starts to say, we need your help. During the month of May, we are trying to raise $35,000 to keep Feminist Frequency going. Everything that we do, including the podcast that you're about to listen to, costs us money. And so we need you to help us keep producing the vital work that we're doing. Do you like our podcast? Do you like our web series? Do you like the writing that we produce and put up on the web? We think you do. We also think that you want us to do new, better, more things. And we can't do that without your support. So take a moment, go to feministfrequency.com/donate, pledge your support. We thank you so very much. And now on with the show.
They painted a racing stripe over exposed brick. That is a crime. Okay?
Dear Philip, please make that be the teaser this week.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 25. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my personal fab two, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And the very sick Ebony Haster.
Oh my God, you guys.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show is a queer extravaganza.
Yay! Woo!
We're going to be talking about Queer Eye, the reboot from the original early aughts show, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. And then we decided to take a trip into the past and rewatch the Wachowskis' first feature film, Bound, about lesbians and the mob. As always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout. Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. And this week, we're going to have a casual after-show hangout, which means we don't really know what we're doing, but it's going to be great anyways. What is Drip, you ask? Well, it is a subscription-based membership platform, and your generous support is what helps us keep this podcast going. If you want to access special perks and exclusive backer awards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. Oh, Ebony.
Oh,
buddy.
Anita.
And you're here with us to spread all your germs,
all
too.
I know. I was concerned, but we have so much going on this week. Not just this amazing podcast, but, you know, other assorted femme freak business.
It's going to happen. No. Ebony's been trying to sneeze for like 20 minutes.
This is great radio.
On
this
the
is
brink
great.
Of a sneeze.
That's right.
I hate living on the brink of a sneeze.
Oh, this is great radio.
Yes.
Listening to someone try and fail to sneeze. Anyway,
it's like you're Bruce Banner in the Avengers, like trying to go Hulk and just getting so close to hulking, and then the Hulkness fades away again.
I'm so sad I wasn't on. I just watched it a couple days ago. I'm so sad I wasn't here for your discussion. Of it, but I listened. You were also lovely without me.
Well,
you know, this just happens.
We sometimes know what we're doing, but if you want to revisit it,
I mean, there's like new questions that have come up in my mind, or that fans, readers have sent in that have made me think
maybe
about
that'll be our bonus episode.
Actually, we should. Let's can work that
Yeah. Cool. Pop culture news.
Yeah. So one item this week. Boy, what a weekend Donald Glover had this weekend. You know, of course, Saturday night, he was both the host and musical guest as Childish Gambino of Saturday Night Live. Friday was May the 4th, which I think the most exciting thing about Solo, a Star Wars story for so many of us, is seeing him as Lando. So, but the biggest thing is that he dropped a video for his new single, This Is America. And wow, I mean, what? This is like an incendiary, really just explosive, powerful video that has the whole, you know, that's what my Twitter feed was all about this weekend, was This Is America. Or like the video, you know, I guess in a nutshell, like it's such a complex, visually rich, like thought-provoking, challenging video. But in a nutshell, if I had to kind of say what I think it's kind of doing, it's like presenting white America's nightmare about black America, which is not rooted in reality, but is fueled by racism and ignorance. And then showing kind of in a way how that fuels the nightmare of being black in America, which is a waking nightmare, right? It's like, so anyway, really powerful stuff. So Congrats to him for releasing an amazing video.
Have you had a chance to see the video yet,
Anita?
So I'm clear, once again, lagging behind. Y'all, I have no strength in my body. And given the amount of like hardcore drugs I'm on right now for this cold, I knew I did not have it within my spirit to watch a Donald, like a multi-layered performance art piece by Mr. Donald Glover, an attempt to record. I was just like, I am seeing purple elephants, period.
That
video is like a lot.
You're just watching it, you're like, okay. Oh, yeah. Shit.
Yeah. So I'm just going to, you know what it reminds me of is the conversations about it remind me of the conversations people have about Kara Walker pieces. You guys know that artist, Kara Walker. I'm sure if you like Googled her and saw her, she's famous for her silhouettes. And she's the one who did that the piece at the Domino Sugar Factory, and it was like the Google it after they said and you'll know what I'm talking about. But but it seems like the kind of conversation, very strong responses immediately, and people at the same time saying like, I need to go watch this 17 more times before I even will have a hint of what I think about it.
Yeah, absolutely, it's extremely provocative, and like I only watched it once, and it's one of those like the imagery is already just kind of burned into my mind. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing, because it's so powerful. And Donald Glover, like, as a but I mean, and I don't want to take away, like, let's also acknowledge, wow, what a amazing dancer and performer and everything Donald Glover is in this video also. Like, on that level, it's just amazing to watch this artist at work, because he goes through so many kind of facial, I mean, he like the dancing that he does in this video and how evocative it is of so many different emotions is
I like. I like Childish Gambino. I'm super into the stuff he's doing. Yeah. I still always see him as the guy from Community.
Sure.
It's really sometimes hard for me to like remove that. And it's taken a while. Like, it's just, it's fun. It's so, you're watching this and you're like, my brain is kind of doing this like jagged shifting thing of being like, no, that's just a character that this person played. Yeah. And this is another character this person's playing, you know, like in different ways. So, well, cool. All right. Check out the video.
Yeah.
I'd be curious what you think of it.
I mean, like I said,
when you have a little,
I don't know, maybe I'll just surrender to like the hallucinatory imagery and just like go on a Robitussin ride with Childish Gambino.
Yeah.
See what I think.
All right. So this week we kind of found ourselves in this little queer bonanza, which we're all pretty excited about.
To be fair, aren't we
always?
We are.
It's true.
We're here. We're queer. Get used to it.
Kind of. But, you know, So before we get into the main topics, I want to just give a little bit of historical context. In terms of queer representations in the media, like, I'm not going to go into a big thing, but I just want to position how quickly or how So when I was growing up, like my generation, to be young and queer meant that you didn't really have a lot of access to queer representations. And I remember the generation before mine was like, we basically had Dykes to Watch Out For by Alison Bechdel, and that was it. We got to have more communities on the internet. You know, like I grew up around a lot of queer women specifically as a teenager, and there were like lesbian bookstores occasionally that you could find, but there was still pretty much it was not accepted to be gay or queer in any way, right? And the media that showed queer representations were such a big, huge deal, right? Like Brokeback Mountain, Ellen, her show coming out and kissing a woman and losing advertisers because of it. Boys Don't Cry showing a trans representation.
Changed my life.
Yeah.
Like, and I totally get that there's a lot of, you know, criticisms and conversations about that film now, but, you know, for young trans people at the time, or people like me who had never had felt, I mean, so isolated and so completely alone. I mean, that movie was just a it was the world cracking open a little bit and saying, we acknowledge you exist, right? Which was transformative.
Yeah. And so I remember a couple of years ago being like, oh my God, there's so many more queer representations in the media just generally. Like, it's just, it kind of, like, some of them are just, like, nobody cares, and some of them are bigger deals, and it's just, it's around a lot more, which shows the shifting of generational acceptance of queer representations
to a larger degree than it was, but still there's a lot of work there, right?
Yes, yes.
And it's interesting seeing like the backlash that came against Boys Don't Cry recently with some students where we were like, you have no idea how important this film was, right. But also there is some progress in that in and of itself, right?
Right? I mean, I think that the conversations, I think that we need to hold current media that represents trans people to those standards, right? I'm not saying that the thrust of those arguments and those conversations is very important, but we also will, you know, there's a way that, I mean, a critic of mine puts this, a critic that I admire puts this sometimes where he's like, we can't totally blame media from the past for not being media made in the present. And I mean, like, you can look at that multiple ways. Like, it doesn't mean I'm going to overlook any racism or bullshit in old media. And yet, like, if media in the past could have been really meaningful and powerful and valuable to certain oppressed people, sort of almost in spite of the fact of not being what, you know, we would call, like, perfect or not or lacking, you know, unproblematic today, right?
Yeah.
Because it was so, like, if you were just a population that never saw yourself represented, I mean, any kind of, you know, I mean, like, it didn't occur, I think, to most trans people back then. I mean, I'm sure there were people like, oh, you know, would have been great if they'd cast a trans actor, but, like, just to have this high-profile, well-respected, celebrated film, I mean, it was, you know, it was huge.
It was. And something like Brokeback Mountain was such a massive cultural phenomenon mm-hmm. in a way that wouldn't happen today. If that movie came out today, it would just be another movie.
Yeah.
But at the time, yeah. especially having straight actors pretend to be gay
right.
was, like considered brave, quote unquote.
Yeah, those
in this
actors
way.
Like, wow, yeah. how brave of.
And that's the same thing with, we're going to talk about Bound, which they had a hard time casting actors who would play, like, have really intimate sex scenes and play lesbians. And so, like, the time has shifted. So, but I just want to position that because it's relevant to the fact that, like, there is this reboot. So one of the main topics for this week is Queer Eye, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a reboot from a show called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy that was on Bravo in 2003. That is how we say that. And it was a show where gay men transformed, like, it was a makeover show where gay men transformed straight men. And it was really popular. It won an Emmy in 2004. It was a huge deal. So, you know, of course it got rebooted because everything is being fucking rebooted today. And the Netflix show that is out right now is getting really, really high praise and really, like, acclaim. And people in my community have been like, yo, you should watch this show. So so we watched some of it.
Yeah.
I have feelings about it.
Me too. I mean,
I have no feelings. Just kidding.
One thing that I think it's heartwarming at times. It has, like, it works as, like, this sweet, heartwarming story at times for me. And yet, I guess one issue that I have with it is that the Fab Five, right? They come to these sort of these straight men who are in one way or another struggling with their image, their everything, you know, kind of in their lives. They aren't really making connections with women and so on. And so a big part of the show for me is the emotional intelligence of the. It's not just about the style, the fashion, and the cooking, which is all great, you know. But it's like these men also try to come in and bring, like, some emotional intelligence into the lives of these straight men. Like, you have to be vulnerable, you know. If you shut down these feelings, then you're going to lose these feelings, and, like, that stuff is all, I think, very true and very valuable. And yet, what my problem is that that shows like this, and maybe the shows like this reinforce the idea that sort of, like, that kind of emotional intelligence or, like, understanding that vulnerability is a kind of strength and not a kind of weakness, that that's still the realm of, like, the queer masculinity. And, oh, of course, these straight guys, you know, we straight guys need a little help from the queer folks to, like, understand that, rather than expecting, you know, arrival of a straight masculinity that embraces and has that kind of emotional intelligence as part of its, you know, part of what's considered masculine in for straight men, I guess, or can be can be within the realm of straight masculinity.
So how many episodes did you all watch?
I watched the third episode based on your and we have to talk about
I know
that third
and I don't want to I want to talk about the first episode first.
I watched 1 and 3.
Okay. So oh, but no, so my jokes aren't going to land for episode 2.
I'll go land with me.
Okay. To be fair, your jokes aren't going to land anyway, but they'll land with the audience.
Fair. So the first episode, I was like, oh, this is cute and warm. And I kept being like, you have this man who's just like, he's so sincere and genuine. And like, I understand why they chose that as the first episode, right? Because it was like this guy who you wouldn't think would be accepting of queer men, who might be a little homophobic, who says things, you know, like wears the pants in the family. Yeah. And then they sort of badly explain how that doesn't.
Very badly.
It was so bad. Explain why that's not the way it works. But like, there was something really heartwarming about this guy's openness to like transform in some ways and change his life. And then with his ex-wife, like I thought it was really sweet.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, he keeps saying early on things like, you know, you can't fix ugly, right? Like he sees himself very much as like he's just internalized this idea that he is like ugly, undesirable, etc. And, you know, like seeing these guys come in and work on him, like the sort of emotional and psychological aspects of how he feels about himself, you know, that being as important, if not more important, a component as the food and the fashion and everything, or like these things are all woven together. But you know, that to me was I really appreciated seeing that. You know, I think that there is valuable stuff in there.
I felt like this this show was such a genealogical mapping of the stuff we talk about at Femme Freak. This was such an interesting offshoot of our discussion last week, Carol, about incel culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have this insistence in incel culture that women are there, women, their bodies, you know, right, are there to service the needs of straight men. And they aren't meant to be autonomous beings outside of that, right? So one of the things that I found really interesting about this show is how you have, you know, the Fab Five come in, and I've only seen the two episodes. I think there's another episode in the series where they actually make over another queer man, correct?
I think
I saw that. But for the most part, it's, even though it's no longer called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, it's called Queer Eye More Than a Makeover, which I think is a very interesting title change. But it's very interesting that they come in and they do this for men who want to please their women, right? Straight men who are either with women that they don't feel they're doing enough for, or men who are having trouble connecting with women. And I just think like there's something, so radical in a way about acknowledging the interior emotional lives of straight men and allowing them to be vulnerable on screen. And I do think it's interesting, as you said, Caro, that like the opening up of this is coming through queer masculinity, right? You know, like they're being allowed to say these things and show their vulnerability through queer men, because straight men are assumed to not yet have access to that emotional toolbox. But I think, you know, the first episode with, I think his name is Tom, I think it's like justifiably, even if you haven't seen the show, you know about Tom and Abby because it was like this love story for the ages, right? Like this woman that he says he's in love with and they, for whatever reason, can't be together. And having not seen the episode, I was a little suspicious because sometimes the world being what it is, when there is a dude who's insistent upon being with this one woman and they're not together, I'm like, maybe there's a reason why y'all ain't together, you know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe she doesn't want to be with you, dude. It's not some star-crossed thing, right? But I completely fell for it. Fell for the okey-doke. When it comes to cheap sentimentality, I fold like a cheap shirt. That's whatever. That's who I am. But yeah, I appreciated the fact that they were saying like, yeah, straight men, it's, you're allowed to have these feelings and have this longing and loneliness and like need for connection. But yeah, you also do have to put in the same kind of work that, you know, other people do.
Yeah, totally. I thought it was when they were in the mattress store and they, like, the two dudes, Jonathan and whoever else was with him,
like jumped on the bed together and like was sort of being like cuddly, and then he just jumped in with them, yeah. And I kept being like, man, shit, like there's still lots of homophobia without a doubt, but like that, it just had this moment of like, you're just down for this, and you're like, cool, and this doesn't challenge your masculinity, this doesn't challenge your sense of self and who you are, you're like, and then at the end, listening to him talk about, he's like, we're friends, like, he hung out with these people for like 3 or 4 yeah. days, and he, like, it felt like, obviously, the show is very, 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 scripted and edited and, like, planted, like, when you see her walking, the shot at the car when she walks up, like, you know that they were like, okay, go, right? But it's still like, I was like, wow, you really like changed this dude's life and like had this really big yeah. impact. And he's going to think differently about exposure to queer folks in general.
Right. I mean, they as structured and polished, and the show is, for my taste, of at times a little too like reality TV polished, kind of artificial, but the emotions that, yeah, that Tom feels in the end where he's, you know, he's sort of moved to tears by his experience with these guys, like, that's, there's, you know, it's yeah. sweet to see this straight guy. Yes.
I want to give us a bunch of time to talk about season three or episode three, but yes. I have a couple of comments about episode two.
Sure.
All right. So, first of all, like, one of the story arcs of that one is that the guy is very closed off. He doesn't make mm-hmm. eye contact. He doesn't like to be touched. And so they kept touching him. They kept, like,
that's
hugging
not cool.
him. I know. And, like, and so the arc was that he became more open and that he made eye contact and he, like, voluntarily hugged them and that kind of thing. But I just kept being like, if you don't want to be touched, don't touch a person.
Yeah.
So that bothered me. The other thing is that he had this beautiful long hair and this beautiful beard. And, like, this was very, so the ways that they do makeovers from what I've seen, so he's was he Indian?
Yes,
I think he was Indian.
Because
Pakistan is Pakistani, and yeah, they talked about like
exactly,
similarities
like
in culture.
Yes.
I was like, this, you're making over people to be acceptable to like mainstream white folk. So like, you know, they trimmed his beard down, they cut his hair short. He looked fine. I thought he looked way better before.
Sure. I mean, I do think that there's a sense in which, for this person, and again, this is purely like the sense I get from this 45-minute highly, you know, polished television episode. But I do get the feeling that for him, the beard and the hair and everything were a part of his sort of way of building that wall and of just not,
yeah,
like,
but that's also how they're framing it, so you don't
sure,
know,
right? That's what,
like,
I mean.
There's just a, yeah. I was like, oh my God, that beautiful hair. Why yeah. are you cutting that off?
Sure.
Also, they don't know what a tech professional looks like. So when he was like, I was like, do not have him walk into a meeting in a suit in like a tech meeting. Like,
right.
We can have a whole conversation about like tech aesthetic and like issues around that, but like the whole time I was like, no, you don't get it. You don't understand.
Like, t-shirt and jeans.
Yeah, t-shirt
like,
and jeans is totally fine.
Yeah. Where was that episode?
They're all in Georgia.
Okay, this was
episodes were all in Georgia. Around Atlanta.
I mean that area, I feel like for the third one they go to Florida about it. No?
I don't think so.
No, the Marine guy, he was definitely in Georgia too.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is one of my problems with the show. And to be honest, like, I'm never going to watch another episode of this show. I watched the original when it was on a bit, but this kind of show, like makeover show, it's just not my jam. So whatever.
Yeah.
But one of the things that drives me crazy about these shows is the way, the patronizing tone that underlies the necessity of the makeover, right? So even though the Fab Five are, like, their studio is based in Atlanta, I have no idea where they actually all live. But there is, nevertheless, this distinction made between, like, the city guys who are going in to these rural or suburban areas and who are going to Cinderella-style, you know, grant them culture and better grooming, you know? Mm-hmm. And there is this really gross class aspect
yeah,
to it that I did
sure.
not like. There is a really gross sizist aspect to it that I don't like. So I'm blanking on the guy who does the cooking, you know, but when he goes into Tom's house, he opens up the pantry door and he says, So you can see, you know, that you're clearly a guy who likes making things from scratch, but then there's also this stuff like fudge rounds and whatever. And I'm like, hey, you know what? People are allowed to have like convenient treats without that grimacing effect. And at the beginning of episode 3, they're all in the car doing like the intro.
Yeah.
And they're reading off the stats and they're like, okay, so he's 6 foot tall and 290 pounds. And Karama's like, big guy. Yeah. And the grimace on his face was so disgusting to me, you know, like I felt like part of what is supposed to make this show work is that, you know, these fairy godmothers are coming in and transforming these Cinderellas, right? But that depends upon them being seen as like these, you know, country yokels in a way that is at least partially false, you know, and sure. certainly patronizing in a lot of its ways. Yeah. So I didn't pick up on that as much when I was younger watching the original version, but this time around, like, it really was off-putting to me. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about episode 3, because that one, I watched the first 10 minutes of it and immediately text both of you being like, because we were like, let's just watch the first 2 episodes. I was like, you have to watch this episode. So it starts out with them being pulled over by a cop, and obviously
Cromo is driving. By the way,
Cromo's driving, and he Cromo
is that
Cromo? Cromo Brown.
Yeah.
He was obviously upset and was like, "Oh fuck! Oh fuck! Oh fuck!" Turns out it was a gag, that it was the nominator of the person that week.
Yes.
All the jokes
of all the I lost my shit, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, like all the other dudes were like, oh, whatever. Yeah. And you could see that Karamo and also Tan,
yeah.
were both like the only brown people who were like, oh, this is not
good. And at the end of the episode, Karamo, you know, reveals, he was like, you know, when that happened, I was like, fuck this guy. I mean, he didn't say fuck this guy, but, you know, like, here's another white cop, you know, doing this kind of thing. Like, I think the intensity of his reaction to that moment was edited out or hidden, possibly by himself, in that scene when he has to kind of laugh off the prank, right? But I think in that later scene, he reveals, like, no, this was not a joke. And I immediately thought, you know, okay, this is who I'm gonna have to bite my lip and service this guy who thinks this of me, or and who doesn't think about the implications of pulling a gag like this.
And all of that got the severity of all of that, and the fact that they were making over a Trump supporter, and the fact that they were doing all this, got completely erased because
this fucking episode.
It made me so mad. They they're driving back from Atlanta together, and they're in the car, and they're doing these long wipes in between their conversations because they're like bonding, and they're talking about how being oppressed as a black person and being oppressed as a good cop are the same fucking thing.
Yeah,
I was like losing my shit.
Yeah, and the idea that, like, coming together as two individual people bonding over Bone Thugs and Harmony has anything to do with, like, you know, systemic, you know, oppression of black people by the police. I was just like, I don't care if you two personally get along. That has nothing to do with the sort of larger cultural issues at play here. I just felt this episode was so fucking offensive.
Exactly. It's such a problem because so many people will watch this and feel like, oh, this is all we need to come together. We need a little understanding between, like, just give every white cop a gay black best friend and they can hash it out and we'll be, yeah. But it's not about, like, it completely erases the fact that it is about systems, right? It is about systems. And totally. Yes, they don't make Corey confront in any way or talk about the fact that he is supporting a white supremacist presidential candidate.
They literally say Black Lives Matter weren't heard, and the cops also weren't heard.
Yes, yeah. The cops weren't heard.
Like, they were like, I wrote down so much of this dialogue because it was infuriating. If we could just talk and learn from each other, everything would be fine. And then he's like, I respect you so much as a police officer. Yeah. And, like, it totally, it's that bullshit of, like, there are good cops and some bad apples. And that's not true, as you both have been talking about. And then, like, they are both crying, and then Karamo is like, this changed my life. I hated you cops before. I'm like, you still should.
You should, right.
Like, and then, they just ignored. Yeah. Like, they showed that he had the MAGA hat, but they were like, cool, we're still going to just
yeah.
pretend like this is cool and we're going to use this as the story arc to mm-hmm. like get like white liberal fucking people to yeah. be like, oh, this is feel good and this is yeah. how this is how change happens
exactly.
and everyone comes together and like, are you fucking kidding me?
That's yeah. the danger and the damage of media like this is that so many white people, it reinforces this idea of, oh, you can be a good person and vote for Trump or, without having to think about like the reality of the oppressive administration that you are supporting and how that has a material impact on the lives of marginalized people.
I can't believe that the people who told me this show was good didn't qualify this. Like, you can right. like the show, but, like, the fact that there wasn't the tiny little, but there's an episode, like, yeah. Right. Right, like, nothing.
Like, everyone should be freaking the fuck out about this episode.
I was shocked when yeah. this came up because
yeah,
of how.
Me too.
Ugh.
I was like, people are liking the show, and people, this, like, why wasn't this episode a huge thing on my Twitter feed? Why? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I was flabbergasted.
I was, too, and then I was so glad you wanted us to watch this one, because it, you know, further confirmed for me that I'm not going to be watching any more of this. But I have zero ability to resist a polished presentation, right? So at the same time that, you know, I'm boggled, absolutely boggled by this conversation that Corey and Karamo are having in the car on the way back from Atlanta, and I'm like, this is bullshit. At the same time, I was so moved by every scene where he talks about his father. I lost my mother.
Too.
And again, we don't get to see men being open this way a lot of the time. And when we do, it does have to do with like their relationships with women, right? But he's talking about his relationship with his father. And I just felt like, oh man, you know, just like that bare-faced honesty. I felt like, oh, this show owes me $10 for making me feel, because I was so mad. I was
yeah,
so
I
mad.
Mean, the reason why people aren't, why like your friend, I think, why a lot of people aren't talking about this is because a lot of people still don't understand that these are issues about systems,
mm-hmm.
right? And it doesn't mean that we can't have sympathy for, you know, for Corey as a man who, you know, loves his father, right? Those kinds of things. But he, that doesn't change the fact that, yeah, he is a participant in these systems. And
that
like,
Karamo should still live in fear
yes,
as a black
exactly.
queer man
yes.
in the world. And
yes.
having this conversation didn't change that. And having 20 conversations like
yeah.
this is not going to change that.
Right. Uh-huh. It's yes.
Yeah. Oh, were you going to say something?
Yeah, just there's no common cause with white supremacists. Bye.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to say the last word on this, not on this topic, on Queer Eye, because in episode 2, they painted a racing stripe over exposed brick. That is a crime. Okay?
Dear Philip, please make that be the teaser this week. Out of nowhere, no context, just
it's
they painted a racing stripe over exposed brick.
It's literally the only note I made on episode 2. Like, that beautiful exposed brick, they painted the whole thing like black with like a white racing stripe or something. And I was like, you can't undo that. Fuck you and your bad design. Okay.
Hey, all you wonderful Feminist Frequency Radio listeners. It's me, Carolyn. I'm here with Ebony, and we want to take a moment to tell you about something really cool and fun we're doing that you may not know about. We have a new podcast called Cinema Ball. Ebony and I both just really love movies. We love the chance to talk about movies, to get really nitty-gritty. You know, whether they're awful movies or great movies, you know, cult films, genre films, we are way into all of it. Cinema Ball is a podcast where each week we link from one film to another through something like an actor, a director, a producer, and, you know, just to give it a little kind of gamey structure, my goal is to get us to the Jean-Claude Van Damme vehicle knockoff in which he plays a fashion designer, but really the fun of Cinema Ball is just the conversations that we get to have about movies each week.
That's right. And as the person playing defense, I'm determined to keep Caro and myself away from having to watch this shitball movie knockoff. So every time Carolyn gets us a little bit closer, I try and pull us back. We are watching some amazing movies and some not so amazing movies, but what never changes is how fun the show is, and we really hope you guys will tune in.
Come on over, give it a listen. We really think you'll like it, and thanks so much for being Feminist Frequency Radio listeners.
Listen to Cinema Ball.
Cinema Ball.
All right, so Bound is a 1996 Wachowski film. Mm-hmm. It is their first feature-made film. It's about two lesbians who try to steal $2 million from the mob. Just personal story, like when I was a young queer lesbian, we watched the fuck out of this movie like over and over again. Like this and But I'm a Teenager and everything early Angelina Jolie were like, so going back and watching this, at, well, like Gia and Foxfire and
this is why you're so fucked up now.
It's fair. Totally fair. So watching it again was weird. But so some things about it. So some people have said that they made this movie to show that they could make a feature-length movie because they were trying to shop The Matrix around and no one was buying it. But Lana Wachowski said that that's not true. They just decided to focus on making their own
dictatorial debut.
Also, fun fact, do you know who Susie Bright is?
Yes.
So I'm not a huge fan of her work in general, but she's like a feminist, like pro-sex, quote-unquote, writer and whatever. She was a consultant on The Sex Scene, which I'm like, cool, good job, on The Sex Scenes. And she also was the cameo. She had a cameo on The Bar as the woman that Corky tries to pick up. Mm-hmm. So, fun facts.
I had so much fun rewatching this movie. So when we, dear audience members, this is how the sausage is made. We throw out a bunch of ideas about what we'd like to watch and talk about on upcoming episodes. And Carol and I were batting around the idea of going back into the vaults and, you know, instead of watching something new, you know, talking about like, you know, kind of classic scenes or things that were really kind of culturally important and whatever. And I'm so glad we were able to watch this one again because the joy of watching it, first of all, like you, Anita, I was like, oh, this is why I am who I am when it comes to certain women. And I just want to apologize to every young queer woman, every young little lesbian, baby bisexual woman like myself when this movie came out. We were fooled into thinking there were a lot more Corkies out there than there are. There are not. And the ones that are out there are not nice people, by and large. They know what they have. They're like Shane from The L Word, and they're assholes. But I was just like, oh, man, I forgot how much I was into this movie, you know? It was just like...
All right, here's a question. Is it purposely bad acting? Because it's a little... I had a hard time
rewatching this. Listen, you don't hire Gina Gershon... Jennifer Tilly and Joey Pants if you want subtle. Like, you don't cast a movie with those three people if you want small movements and small performances.
So it's intentionally, like, it's intentionally.
I mean, you call it bad. I would call it, like, heightened or stylized. Like, yeah. I think that it is a film. Sure. It is not.
That's actually what my question was. Like, it's very intentionally supposed to be like that.
Yes.
Well, I think it's part of, because of its neo-noir genre,
it's
right?
It was influenced by, like, Sin City.
It's such a style. It's such a stylish, like, it's obviously a film made on a really, like, low budget, and yet within the constraints of that budget, the way that they find the kind of decor for the apartment and everything, even just, like, the phones and things that suggest that, like, I mean, it's that, like, kind of sharper imagey, sleek, but, you know, kind of 90s neo-futuristic, just stuff, right? There's something to that. So I had not seen this film in many, many years. And, I was immediately aware of how it's working in a noir space. Mm-hmm. And so I actually kind of kept thinking Jennifer Tilly. Wait, it's Jennifer
Tilly. Yeah.
Tilly, like, what's her character's name?
Violet.
Violet, of course. Like, I kept thinking that she was going to be the full-on femme fatale that... At the end, we would discover that it was that her manipulation of Corky was also a ruse.
Wait, have you seen the movie before?
Yeah, but I'd forgotten how it ends. Okay, I'd forgotten how it ends. Like, I mean, I remembered the sex scenes and stuff, but I'd just forgotten how it ends. And so the fact that in the end, it doesn't end with that kind of... it kind of reaffirms the bond that these two women have and the way that these... manipulative, asshole, self-absorbed men cannot be a part of that, right, is ultimately very,
yeah.
It's very, like, as a queer person, it's very kind of validating and, like, invigorating still, right?
I love that it was, Vi gets to occupy several positions, you know, in the noir space. Like, so, yeah, she does occupy the position of the femme fatale.
Yeah.
But she also gets to occupy the position of, like, you know, the hero's love interest, like the good girl, right? Because her relationship with Corky is real, is sincere in a way that it isn't with Caesar.
Yeah.
You know, it's she's not playing Corky in the way that she does Shelley or Mickey or Johnny or whoever else, Joey Two Times, whatever, you know, the mob guys. So, you know, I thought it was just a really tight, fun exploration of the kind of tropes of,
yeah.
of the noir genre.
And I love, too, that it's a very small film in the sense that, so it takes place in Chicago, but it's so rare for a film that, I mean, the city itself, Chicago, is really not, like, this is not, like, a Chicago film. It doesn't have, like, a Chicago identity. There's not, like, establishing shots of Chicago. There's very few, like, outdoor scenes. This film is all, like, interiors. It's pretty much, like, it could almost be a play or, like, a theater mm-hmm. piece because it, yeah, it's just, it's all, it, I mean, and I think that gives it more of, like, this kind of pressure cooker kind of quality, right? It's you could transplant it to New York or wherever, but it could still have that same kind of intensity in these interior spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about Gina Gershon's lockpicking earrings and how
dope those were?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
When I was younger, people used to tell me I looked like Gina Gershon, and I was like, but she's weird looking. Am I weird looking? And then I grew up and was like, oh, she's fucking hot. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't look anything like her, but I'll take that compliment.
You know, I can sort of see it.
I see the resemblance.
You don't do that weird thing with your lips that she does, though, thank God. Yeah, we're
showing that thing, yeah.
You can't see that. I just tried to, yeah.
Good radio. Yeah. We produce super good radio. Mm. I loved the look of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The blacks and whites. You know, it's obviously a film that's in color, but really, you know, like employs blacks and whites and lines and angles to suggest black and white film and the noir films that it's harkening back to. But also, I think is meant to, you know, suggest like a moral compass in a way, you know, like black and white, right and wrong, but the whites are like often smudged, they're dirtied in an honest way,
mm-hmm.
you know, so like the whites that we do see, like Corky's tank tops, for instance, you know, they're not pure white, but they're not dirtied from blood the way that Caesar's white shirts are, right? Like
yeah.
It's kind of honest work.
Corky,
I just thought it was very interesting visually, the way they set that up.
I'm really enjoying listening to you talk about it. I had a hard time getting into watching it again, and I sort of like kind of had it on the background as I was working, just because mm-hmm. I was like, I can appreciate all of the things that you're saying, and I can appreciate that it's like important filmmaking, but I was just like, I was kind of bored by it. And I feel like maybe it had such a different meaning for me previously that is not necessary for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, I was kind of like, okay, cool. Not really like, because I think I mentioned this when we talked about this. I tried watching the movie again like 2 months ago and I turned it off because I was like, whatever. I'm bored with this.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it didn't hold up for me, but I still think it's like I would recommend watching it. I feel like it's an important sort of film in the landscape of queer films. There is something to be said about like the creators and like. Because when it came out, it was what we assumed were two men making a movie about lesbians.
It was so jarring to see that credit at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the first thing you see after the movie ends is like directed by like the Wachowski brothers,
mm-hmm.
which, the arc of those creatures. I mean, I suspect that was something they both felt on some level even then, right?
Sure.
But
that was a thing that we struggled like that often, you know, felt like we're like you talked about this on a previous episode with the blue is the warmest color,
right?
Where it's like a man telling the story of young lesbians and like, is that exploitative? Is it not? You know, like what is that in that case? Some of the sex scenes were and the struggles with that. So it's kind of interesting now to look back on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's the way that it handles this bound, the way that it handles the sex, like, is so, to me, I think it's so great. Like, I love that Gina Gershon gets the line, you know, something like, there's nothing I dislike more than a woman who feels guilty for wanting sex or mm-hmm. whatever, right? Like that is a line that it affirms female sexuality, right?
Yeah.
And not as objects of desire, but as desirers.
Well, and there's obviously, there's several lines like that that do that I don't think I noticed that when I was younger, but mm-hmm. I notice it now. And then also, like, the little bits about, like, you were talking about the sort of stereotype of quirky and how, like, we've all dated those women and
we all
know those women. No, I did. It was a disaster. But, like, the truck thing was just, I mean, like,
of
so
course,
dead
yes.
on. Like,
yes.
so dead on in every way.
Wait, Jennifer Ooh. Tilly just says, of course.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then, like, the upgrade at the end. Like, yes. just yes. fucking hilarious. Uh-huh. But I liked the line where, like, and that's when I found out that Susie Bright was a consultant in the sex scenes, I was like, oh, it makes so much more sense because there is a realness to, this isn't just, like, what men think women
yes.
do when they have sex. And
yep.
there's the line where she's like, did you plan all of this? Mm-hmm. And Jennifer Tilly, Violet's like, if I say yes, will you take your finger out?
Yeah.
Your fingers out. And she's like, no, yes. And like that whole exchange was so well done.
I thought it was so interesting. So I did not learn that Susie Bright was the sex scene coach or whatever until researching it for this podcast. But I remember thinking, like, there's something so interesting about the fact that the first sex scene we see between them, Violet is the more active person, right? You know, in terms of caressing and bringing Corky to orgasm. And I think, in as much as you can say this feels authentic to, like, lesbian sex experience, that felt authentic in a way that I don't know would have been possible without an actual lesbian consulting on it. Because I think the instinct would have been to have Corky be the aggressor as the more masculine of center character. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you although know? I would say that in this film, it feels intentionally written so that Violet was playing this role and showing the empowerment of, like, femme women and that, like, the desire to have sex and own sex.
So, yeah, like, absolutely. But, you know, the assumption that, like, if you are the more, like, you know, for lack of a better word, butch of the two, will you be accepting of that kind of behavior,
sure,
right?
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So I was glad that they showed, like, yeah, you know, this is, there's no, you know, man here,
right.
you know, like, this is not about, like, who penetrates whom
right.
and whatever.
Which
it's
makes
not
that,
about who wears the pants.
Yeah, exactly.
And that line, which makes that line at the end, or that little exchange at the end so great, where Corky is like, you know what the difference is between us, and she says no, and Corky says I don't either.
It was nice. So if you haven't seen Bound, like, it's worth checking out.
It's on Amazon Prime.
I mean,
if you got that account, check it out.
I mean, I'll go one higher than Anita. Like, I think it's a legitimately good, stylish, interesting film that is, that, you know, I think is still a good watch, you know.
Totally. I was tired all weekend, so I was like, meh, I gotta watch it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you can't deny, like, the Wachowskis know how to put together a fucking film, you know, so.
I mean, Jupiter Ascending, you know.
Can we please talk about that kooky
Jupiter? I never saw it.
It's so bananas.
Maybe
that will be one of our rollbacks.
Yeah, we should do that. All right. Freak out time. Carolyn?
Yeah.
What is your freak out this week?
I read the first volume of a comic series called Paper Girls, which is by, it's written by, like, Brian K. Vaughan, who is also known for his work on, like, Saga and other, I think, various other.
Why the Last Man.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. So I'm only, like I said, one volume into Paper Girls. Like, the narrative of it, it's right now, it still seems just kind of goofy and a bit messy, but the character, so it takes place in, like, 1988, I think. It's about these four young women who have like a paper route, and in I think Cleveland, and one like the night after Halloween, they're out delivering papers, and basically like all kinds of crazy shit starts to happen. But the characters, they're great. You know, you have it's a great assortment of four women, you know, young women with really great different kind of personalities. The art is beautiful. It's beautiful. It's so makes such amazing use of color, and it does. It has a such an authenticity to it in terms of capturing the period in ways that don't feel like flashy or deliberately kind of in your face. So, for instance, when sort of the main character, the character we kind of meet first, you know, is waking up in the morning, there's like a Depeche Mode poster on her wall, you know, just like one example. And it's not like the art doesn't do like whole, look at this Depeche Mode poster here. We're doing the whole 80s, like, you know, thing. But it's there, and for people like me who it's such a distinct, like, it's an actual poster. It's an, and for people like me, you're like, oh, whoa, hey, I remember that poster. And the it's full of the world of the book is full of that kind of authentic period detail, which I really enjoy, in ways that, as I say, they do feel authentic, which is important. And yeah, so I'm curious to see where it's got, like I said, this wild sci-fi story. I don't really have a good handle on it yet. Some of the writing is a little kind of clunky and self-conscious, and yet because of the art, because of the characters, you know, because of how it's treating the period, I'm very much going to stick with it for now and read at least the next volume and see how it goes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ebony, what are you freaking out about other than your health?
Yeah, trying to stay alive. So in keeping with our queer theme today, by the way, we're going back to aggressively straight content after this week. Everybody who's worried, all straight news all the time.
Yeah, that's
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
So apparently tonight is the annual Met Gala.
Why wasn't I invited?
For real, right? Like, Anita gets invited to some dope shit.
No,
usually,
rarely.
I do. Whatever.
Very rarely.
Y'all listen to this show. You know she's constantly on the move. Normally, I don't give a shit because I don't like leaving the house. But if you got invited to the Met Gala for reals, I would ask to be your security detail.
Our
so
friend
I could
Manveer said that when he's big and famous and gets invited to the Met Gala, I get to go in his pocket. I'll be his pocket date.
I love that.
Yeah.
So much.
Because he's, you know, a big
so
dude and
much.
I'm a little
yo,
bit.
Shout out to Manveer. I love that
He's
dude.
The best.
He is the dude. Ugh, love that. You know what's going to be great is I bet he doesn't listen to the podcast, but you should send him this link.
I will.
My employees love you. Okay, so anyways, Met Gala is tonight. The only part that us plebeians care about is the fashion, right?
Yeah,
so we watch
totally.
Like the red carpet. And the theme changes every year. And some, like, one year it was punk, you know? And so watching, like, these, you know, very wealthy, very beautiful people interpret what they thought punk was hilarious. Some people got it, some people not so much. The theme this year apparently is like the Catholic Church.
Shut up.
What? Right, yo. Okay, so anyways, I read my freak out for this week is this piece by John Paul Brammer, who is a great writer, and I follow
him
on Twitter.
I wish you could see me and Carolyn's face right now because I'm so confused.
Right. So, The piece that I, and we'll put a link up to this, is called The Met Gala's Cute, But the Catholic Church is Still Incredibly Homophobic. And the header is, at tonight's gala, the church will benefit from the gifts of queer people while condemning them, but that's par for the course. And it's all about how, you know, like the celebrations within queer culture of like vitality and color and a certain kind of like what this writer calls Baroque aesthetics, you know, will be, you know, employed in the service of this visual tonight in a way that to him seems completely uncritical.
So, I mean, the Catholic Church is an institution that has historically and, you know, in recent decades done incalculable harm and destroyed the lives of so many young, you know, young people who have, you know, queer people, just children, you know, children. So it's very puzzling to me. I mean, is this, is the idea to kind of take style cues from the church and heighten it to such a degree that it becomes like a kind of a, like an absurd thing, or to kind of make it a critique in some way.
Let me correct what I said. So it says this year's Met Gala theme, celebrities and designers have been asked to conjure their Sunday best. So the Met Gala is always pegged to a specific like exhibit or, you know, you know, kind of, you know, visual, you know, exhibition that's going on, right? So the thing that they're being asked to peg it to is heavenly bodies, fashion, and the Catholic imagination.
Okay.
Exhibit.
I mean...
So anyways, okay. I found this piece, incredibly interesting, right? Because as you're suggesting, there's something so wildly incongruous about choosing this theme with this at its heart at an event that is so unabashedly queer, right? So that, you know, the celebration of like queer designers, the celebration of the queer performers and artists and everything who will be there are being asked to celebrate something that, you know, still to this day, you know, is so, you know, radically unaccepting of who they are.
I guess I can see people doing things that function as a kind of, I don't know, an act of reclamation of some sort, or like to try to kind of I'm just not interested in that because I was raised Catholic. I have no to me that institution is just you know, so reprehensible and has done so much knowingly done so much harm and internally functioned so for so long to protect criminals and perpetrators that I, you know, I don't want to see it in any way celebrated or redeemed personally.
Yeah. So the piece that I found so interesting, and again, we'll put a link to this up, is when he says, tonight at the Met Gala, McQueen, and he's talking about queer designer Alexander McQueen, is being posthumously reintroduced to the faith. His silver crown of thorns is part of the Met's exhibit, a piece that drew objection from the church, which has been coordinating with the Met. It sums up the relationship between the church, queer people, and the Baroque aesthetic they share. The church is willing to use beauty to spread its message, willing to appropriate from the visual vocabulary of queer designers to achieve that beauty, and all too willing to persecute and ostracize queer people while doing it. The current catechism, the official set of principles Catholics follow, says that, quote, homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. I found that phrase so interesting, intrinsically disordered. Anyway, talk about it. Hit me up at Ebony Astor. Let's talk about this piece. I will share the link.
Wow. All right. My freak out this week is Ebony.
What? No, I'm not remotely ready.
So Ebony
excuse me,
is sick. But when she's not sick, she's fucking magic.
Yes.
And here I'm going to tell you a couple of stories about how she's magic.
Oh, my God.
I thought that this was limited to menstruation. So Ebony has in the past predicted the start of my period.
Listen,
to today.
People, Phil, if you don't cut this out, I want to make this clear. I'm not just randomly, obsessively tracking Anita's menses, people. Oh my God. And of course, no one's going to listen to this. Whatever. Go forward.
Okay.
Go forward.
In a way, this has happened on several occasions that has been surprising to me, including one where I thought I was a week off, and you're like, nope, you're going to start today. And
I'm a witch.
Like,
I'm a witch. What do you want from me? I'm
okay,
a witch.
But whatever. I thought that this was like moon magic or some shit, right?
Yeah.
So 2 weeks ago, on our live show at Kickstarter with special guest, friend of the podcast, Jay Smooth, Ill Doctrine, what up? Ebony asked us a question, and it was something like, what celebrity would you not want to be a weirdo in front of, or something like that?
No, it was like, what celebrity, if you just had the chance, you feel like y'all would get along and you'd become friends?
Okay,
like, you just feel like you'd have a connection.
So I said Emily Blunt, and Jay said Erykah Badu.
What?
So
break it down for Anita. Tell the people how psychic I am.
The next day, the exact next day, I'm at the Time 100 Gala, and Emily Blunt walks past me, and I go, ugh! Like, in her face, like an idiot. And so I met Emily Blunt. Then, what, like 5 days later or something, Jay gets into a row with Erykah on Twitter, and we were like, how in the fuck did this happen? Now, Jay wants his credit back. He wants a different experience because his experience wasn't as good as mine.
Right. Well, I have no ability to change people's destinies. I just call it like I see it. And I'm right 67 to 71% of the time.
So, in case you are wondering, Ebony is magic. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to the next prediction.
Shit, me too. I'm a witch. Maybe my emote for Twitch could be a witch.
All right, that is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Remember that you too can join our podcast community and help us bring you this sweet, fresh, spicy content every single week at d.rib/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get this podcast because it really helps spread the word about our show. And you know, while you're getting your fancy makeover and new mattresses and cutting off your beautiful hair, tell your friends too because they might want to check in. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts, including Cinema Ball, at feministfrequency.com. And we want to hear from you. So hit us up on Twitter and let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about on Feminist Frequency Radio. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony.
I am at Robitussin.
Oh, shit. Did I forget to say that we're at FemFreak? Because we're at FemFreak. So follow us there as well. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. And we will see you all next week.
Later.
Bye.